Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you're a virtual member of Beth Emmanuel, consider praying about upgrading by coming home to Hudson, where we are building intentional Messianic Jewish community. The only thing missing is you.
I promised to tell you about Lag BaOmer and what Lag BaOmer is all about, right? Why do we celebrate Lag BaOmer? What does it mean? Well, first of all, let's just get the name straight. Lag BaOmer, you might think Lag BaOmer because you throw logs on the fire at Lag BaOmer, but that's not it, actually. Lag is just, it's the Lamed Gimel. It looks like it says log. It doesn't say log. It says 33. It says 33rd because it's the 33rd day of the Omer. And, you know, Lag BaOmer is the Yahrzeit of a sage that lived in the second century by the name of Shimon Bar Yochai, who happened to die on the 33rd day of the Omer. He told his disciples before he died, he said that he wants them to mark the date as a day of joy. He says, the day of my simcha, the day of my joy on the day of my passing, because he was so confident of the world to come and entering into glory. And so that's Lag BaOmer. That's what it is, basically. Any questions? Lamed is a 30, a gimel is a 3, so 33rd, 33, log. I can understand celebrating it simply on the basis that it's part of Jewish culture, you know, and this is a Messianic Jewish community, so it makes sense. This is what you do. You have a bonfire, and who doesn't enjoy having a bonfire? What's wrong with that? You know, nothing wrong with that. But is there any significance, any deeper significance for us? That's our question today. The question we're going to keep in the back of our minds as I tell you the story of the road to Emmaus. You might have heard this one before, the road to Emmaus. But if I'm going to title this teaching for you, The Road to Emmaus and Maron. Okay, got that? Now, at the beginning of the story of the road to Emmaus and Maron, the Gospel of Luke says, "And behold," this is Luke 24:13. "And behold, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem." Now, identifying this village is notoriously difficult. It's complicated by several things, including the textual variant, but also the existence of more than one village that's called Emmaus. Josephus explains, you know, Josephus, who is a first century historian, he explains that the Greek word Emmaus means warm bath. So he says, "For therein," you know, at any village named Emmaus, "you will find a spring of warm water useful for healing." So the whole ancient world believed, like, if you know, you could go to soak in the hot springs, that was for convalescence, for healing, and they called these places, wherever there was a hot springs, they called it Emmaus. So there was several villages through the land of Israel, several small towns and villages that are called Emmaus because they had hot baths. In fact, Josephus says, "There are warm baths at a little distance from Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee in a village named Emmaus." So the name tends to attach to any village with natural hot springs. Well, because of that, Luke narrows down the field of options for us when he says that this one was 60 stadia away from Jerusalem. Problem is, we can't find an Emmaus that was 60 stadia away from Jerusalem. You know, a stadium converts to about 600 feet, English feet. So 60 stadia would make it about 7 miles away from Jerusalem. There is no Emmaus or any hot springs that we can find 7 miles from Jerusalem. However, there is an Emmaus and a hot springs that's 3.5 miles from Jerusalem. And since they made a round trip, perhaps Luke had in mind that they traveled a total of 60 stadia that day, because they went, they saw the master, he disappeared before their eyes, and then, of course, they hurried back to Jerusalem that same night. So it's this story on the way to this Emmaus where I see two particularly sad-looking, disheartened disciples leaving Jerusalem with their backs to Jerusalem while the festival is still underway. They're on their way to Emmaus when they're joined by a third traveler, a stranger, who asks them what they were discussing, and they tell him about their conversation. Their conversation has been about Yeshua of Nazareth, a prophet, mighty in word and deed, and how they hoped that he was going to be the one who was going to redeem Israel. But he had been crucified by the Romans 3 days earlier, and now his body was missing. So the stranger took up his discourse, and he opened his mouth, saying, "O foolish men, slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and then to enter into his glory?" And then the stranger proceeded to expound upon the Torah and the prophets and the writings and all the scriptures relating to Messiah's suffering and exaltation, and showing them things they had never seen before in those familiar old scriptures. And suddenly they could see the story of Yeshua of Nazareth written from the beginning of the book to the end. This story actually conforms to a well-known pattern in Jewish mysticism. There's a book. We have it in, I brought out a few volumes here just so that you could see there is a book. This is the first three volumes of the 24, 25 volumes we have back in the library. This one's all Aramaic. Have some English translations as well. It's a book called the Zohar. It means the shining or the resplendence, or the brightness. It's a collection of Jewish mysticism, an anthology. It's loosely organized as a commentary on the Torah. But here's the thing. It often frames its mystical discourses within a short travel narrative on the principle that when righteous men, when tzaddikim, are traveling together, they busy themselves with the words of Torah. You know, so it's like if you drive, it's like you and me, we're driving someplace, you know, where it's like, hey, you want to go? We're going to do something together. We're going to speak some words of Torah together. Well, maybe not. But if we were tzaddikim, we would. You know, and so this is to fulfill the commandment that says, you shall speak of them when you walk by the way. So when you're on your way someplace, the Torah is with you and you're talking Torah. So the sages would do this. And typically, in one of the Zohar stories, you've got two rabbis walking along to a certain place where one of them begins to expound upon a deep, esoteric subject. In other cases, it's two or three sages are walking to a certain village when they encounter a stranger who begins to discuss mystical interpretations of the Torah with them. So the short narrative, you know, it typically, you have all these short narratives that are strung together artificially, and they'll introduce, you know, they frame these discourses. So you get to hear the conversations of the sages in the Zohar, and you know, so typically the narrative will start with the name of the two sages that are walking along, and the destination that they're headed to. It'll identify the village they're headed to, and then you have the anonymous third stranger that joins them. Very common form. I'll give you an example of the genre. This is from the introduction, the prologue. Rabbi Eliezer, that's Shimon bar Yochai's son. Rabbi Eliezer undertook a journey to visit his father-in-law, Rabbi Yossi ben Shimon ben Lacunya. Rabbi Abba went with him. Another man followed them, driving their baggage donkey. Look out for this guy. This is this guy, you know, the anonymous one who's just there to drive the donkey. It's like the taxi cab driver, you know. Rabbi Abba said, "This is an appropriate time and place for us to open discourse on Torah," while they're walking. Rabbi Eliezer then began to discourse. And now we get page after page after page of his discourse. Okay, so we'll skip that part. He finishes. At this point, the donkey driver who followed them interrupted with a question. His question turns out to be this genius mystical discourse that he brings. Rabbi Eliezer turns to Rabbi Abba and says, "Don't argue with that fellow. He seems to know some mystery of which we are ignorant." So they say to the donkey driver, "Say what you want to say." So he begins his discourse, a long mystical explanation of the same Torah passage that we've already been over once, but now we see an entirely new perspective of it. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Abba come up to the stranger and kiss him. And they say, in view of this deep insight that you have demonstrated, it is appropriate that you should journey. Is it appropriate that you should journey behind us? Who are you? He replied, don't even ask. But let us continue on our way together and discourse on the Torah. So now the three of them are walking together, and they have an amazing conversation, and the stranger brings all these deep insights into the Torah, after which Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Abba prostrate themselves on the ground before the stranger, and whoosh, he disappears. Then they stand up, look around, and they don't see him. And then they sit down and they cry for a while. They weep for a while, not daring to exchange a word with each other. Finally, Rabbi Abba said, surely what we have been taught is true, that whenever the righteous are traveling on a journey and they occupy themselves with the Torah, they are favored by visits from the other world. Whew. Well, do you see the similarities? I think you probably do. Similarities to the story of the road to Emmaus. But the story of the road to Emmaus, here's the interesting thing. The story of the road to the Emmaus is about 100 years, at least, older than the Zohar. The Zohar was allegedly written by Shimon ben Yochai in the 2nd century, more than 100 years after the story of the road to Emmaus. And in fact, well, you know, Shimon ben Yochai, supposedly the author of the Zohar, not directly, he did not, just like Yeshua, didn't sit down and write the Gospel of Matthew. You know, instead, he taught his disciples and his students these secrets and these mystical teachings, and they passed these on to their students, who eventually wrote it down in Aramaic and compiled it into this collection, this anthology of teachings. That's the story, anyway. And then it was rediscovered in the Middle Ages. And, you know, that's the story. Most scholars believe that the Zohar is a pseudepigraphical work created in the Middle Ages, written in the Middle Ages, falsely attributed to Shimon ben Yochai. In other words, a forgery. I wouldn't go that far. That seems a little strong to me, a forgery. But neither would I try to defend it as an authentic second century document. It's more of an anthology, like I said, an anthology of mystical ideas and traditions. And as a rule, we don't study the Zohar here at Beth Emmanuel. Why? Because it's over our heads. It's not light reading. I don't recommend it. At points, it can be enlightening, definitely. Revealing, poetic, beautiful, inspiring. And at other points, absurd or just tedious. It depends maybe on the reader and his state of being. I don't know. But anyway, please, I don't want you to get the idea to say, oh, Lancaster's now, he's trying to get us to study the Zohar. Not at all. But as you know, Paul Levertov was a master of the Zohar. And the same can be said for Rabbi Lichtenstein the Chassid, who was also called the Evan Zohar, which means the shining stone. Lichtenstein. Yeah, the shining stone. Shimon ben Yochai, I'm going to tell you some stories about Shimon ben Yochai, the alleged author. He died in the Galilee on the 18th day of Iyar, around the middle of the 2nd century. That is the 33rd day of the Omer, the 18th day of Iyar, Lag BaOmer. On the day of his passing, Rabbi Shimon instructed his disciples to mark the date as the date of my joy. So it's traditionally a day of rejoicing, like I said. And since the tradition says that it was on this day that he revealed to his disciples the teaching which became the book of the Zohar, some say that since he brought this spiritual light into the world on that day with the revelation of these deep teachings, that's why we light bonfires, because bonfires are that light up the darkness, light up the night, right? So that's one explanation. In Israel, right now, well, right now as if right now is right now, right? Well, Lag BaOmer, okay. What I'm saying is, in Israel on Lag BaOmer, it's probably already Lag BaOmer in Israel, or just about. Yeah. So in Israel, thousands and thousands of religious Jews gather in Meron, the place where Shimon ben Yochai is buried. They gather at his tomb to celebrate Lag BaOmer. I think more than 200,000 gathered there last year for the ultimate Lag BaOmer party and the biggest bonfire of all time. And since we are commemorating this occasion, I thought, you know, we should learn a little bit about, I'm just going to tell you the legends, stories about, you know, maybe not entirely true stories about Shimon ben Yochai. You know, not entirely true. And, you know, I think mostly true. But not, you'll see what I mean. Here's what I want you to do. We're going to kind of check out of sermon mode, and it'll be story time. You know, I'm just going to tell you stories of this Galilean sage who lived about a century after the Master, in the days after the destruction of the temple, in the days of Trajan and Hadrian, in the days of the academy at Yavne, the days when Shimon ben Clopho and Yehuda Justus were the bishops over the believers in Jerusalem. Shimon ben Yochai, his father, Yochai, was an influential Jew who held some position of influence with the Roman government, a wealthy man. And Shimon became a disciple of Rabbi Akiva and part of the academy at B'nai Barak. That was Rabbi Akiva's academy, which means that, I mean, from that we can deduce a couple things already. Number one, he was not a believer. Number two, he was no friend to the believers. Number three, the believers didn't like him. And number four, he didn't like them. So there, he's not one of our boys in that sense, okay? Just should know that at the outset. I have mixed feelings, actually, about Shimon ben Yochai. On the one hand, he's a hero. He's one of the heroes, the big-name heroes among the sages. And he's a tzaddik, and he's a miracle worker, and he's a father of the mystical tradition. He's all that and more. On the other hand, in many ways, Shimon bar Yochai, ben Yochai, exemplifies many of the attitudes and behaviors and religious impulses which it seems like our master taught against. He's a political agitator. He's a revolutionary. He's no friend of the believers, like I said, whatsoever. He's a self-congratulatory tzaddik who reveled in his own righteousness and merit, hot-tempered sage, not above being vindictive with people even to the point of shooting them with his laser beam eyes. Shimon ben Yochai had a high opinion of himself. He said, "If Abraham is willing, he can effectively intercede and make atonement for all generations from his day until mine, and I'll take it from here." Yeah, he said, "I can intercede for all of them from my day until Messiah comes." Shimon ben Yochai said, "The world possesses not less than 30 righteous men. If there are 30, my son and I are two of them. If there's only 10, my son and I are two of them. If there's only 5, my son and I are two of them. If there's only 2, it's my son and I. If there's only 1, it's me." Yeah. Rabbi Akiva ordained Rabbi Meir as his chief disciple instead of Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Shimon was so offended that he pouted. And Rabbi Akiva had to go and talk nice to him to try to appease him. Despite that, he was a dedicated disciple, dedicated to Rabbi Akiva during the disastrous Bar Kokhba revolt, for which Akiva and his disciples were partially responsible. When Rabbi Akiva was arrested finally by the Romans, Shimon obtained permission through the influence of his father Yochai to visit his teacher in prison in order to continue to receive teaching from him up until the day he died. After the death of Rabbi Akiva and the collapse of the Bar Kokhba revolt, Shimon gathered the other disciples of Akiva and some of his own disciples, and they sat around to discuss the new political situation. There was Rabbi Yehuda ben Eli. There was Rabbi Yossi, the Galilean, I suppose. There was Rabbi Yehuda ben Gerim, Shimon's own disciple, to discuss the new political situation and what's it going to look like going forward now that Rome has thoroughly decimated us and deported our populations. And what's our new posture towards the empire going to be? Rabbi Yehuda ben Eli advocated reconciliation with the Romans. He spoke in praise of the Roman government. He said, "How fine are the works of this people. They've made the roads. They've built the bridges, the aqueducts. They've erected bathhouses." Rabbi Yossi didn't say anything. He sat silently. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, "Yeah. Everything they've done for themselves. They built marketplaces to set their harlots in them. They've built bathhouses to refresh themselves. They've built bridges to put in tollways for themselves, and so on and so forth. Yehuda ben Garim went and reported the entire conversation to the Roman authorities, and they decreed, Yehuda who exalted us, he shall be exalted. Yossi who was silent, he shall be exiled to the city of Sepphoris. And Shimon who spoke against us will be put to death. So as a disciple of Rabbi Akiva, it made sense, you know, Shimon ben Yochai speaking, you know, trash talking the Roman government. He's a political revolutionary. And so the local government ordered him crucified. When Shimon heard about the death sentence, he and his son went and hid themselves in the Beit Midrash. So, I don't know where in the Beit Midrash, maybe in the attic of the Beit Midrash. And his wife would bring them bread and water every day secretly. But as the Roman search intensified, he started to worry that his wife would be arrested and perhaps subjected to torture, and that it would be better for both her and for them if she did not know his whereabouts. So he and his son fled from the Galilee and went to Perea across the Jordan in the region of Decapolis near Gadara, not far from the place where Yeshua divided the loaves and the fish to feed the multitudes, not far from Pella, where the Jerusalem community of Jewish believers had settled during the first Jewish revolt, you know, some 50, 60 years earlier. And they hid themselves there in a cave. And here's an interesting aside. We know from archaeology of this period that this happened all the time. When the modern state of Israel, you know, began, Israeli archaeologists started, they launched a campaign after the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You remember the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in a cave, right? Actually, several caves. So the government launched a campaign to explore every cave in the land of Israel. And they found remnants of Jewish people hiding in caves during this very period, during the Bar Kokhba period. All sorts of artifacts, coins, weapons, foodstuffs, documents, you know, written documents, even tefillin and tzitzit, not to mention the human remains of Roman victims in caves all over the land of Israel. So we can substantiate this Talmudic legend with a little bit of archaeological corroboration, at least to say this was not at all uncommon for Jewish people in those days to hide in caves during this period of unrest. So there they were, Shimon and his son Eliezer living in a cave, no food, no water. So Hashem does a miracle. He makes a carob tree grow outside the cave, at the mouth of the cave, so they can eat the carob pods and keep themselves alive with the carob pods. And he makes a spring come up, so there's fresh water flowing there for them, so they can subsist on the carob pods like John the Immerser, and they have the fresh water. And they live like monks in this cave. I mean, these guys were monks before being a monk was cool. And they devoted all their time to prayer and study and mystical contemplation day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, until 12 years had gone past. 12 years of just focusing on God and His scriptures. And after 12 years, these two men had become so holy, you know, through this just constant focusing on God. Anyway, so Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai has become this mystical holy man. He's sitting at the mouth of the cave, and he sees a bird catcher spreading his net to catch birds. And as he's watching, he would hear a heavenly voice say, "Mercy, mercy." And the bird catcher would pull up the net, but the bird would get away. But sometimes he would hear the heavenly voice say, "The pain of death." And the bird catcher would pull up the net, and the bird would be caught in the net. And he thought to himself, even a bird does not perish except by the decree of heaven. How much more so than we human beings? Which, of course, our master said something almost identical 150 years earlier. According to another version of the story, actually the same story, Elijah then comes and stands near the entrance of the cave, disguised as something or other, someone or other. And he says, "Who will go inform the son of Yochai that the emperor is dead?" Well, when the emperor is dead, all of his decrees are annulled. So Shimon ben Yochai and his son emerge from the cave. It's been 12 years, completely focused on the spiritual. And as they come out of the cave, they're shocked to see the mundane world, people doing mundane things. And the first thing they see is a man working in the field. He's plowing the field. And they say, can you believe this? How foolish that men would forsake eternal life and spirituality in order to make themselves busy and distract themselves with this temporary world of physical matter, this passing away world. And it just irritates them so much. They just get so angry that everything they look at bursts into flames. It's really a problem. Everywhere they go, they're just fuming with, and it's just a big problem. So Hashem says, what are you doing? You come out of your cave to burn up my world? Get back in your cave. So they go back in the cave for another 12 months until the divine voice says, okay, now come out. This time they come out of the cave, the first thing they see is people getting ready for the Sabbath, preparing for the Sabbath. And they're so impressed. People setting aside their mundane things, setting aside the material things of this world, the acquisition and work, and for the sake of God, for the sake of the spiritual alone. They're so impressed. They say, behold, how precious the commandments of God are to his people Israel. Now, as they emerge from the cave, Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, is famous for many other stories and is married to Shimon's daughter, hears that his father-in-law has finally emerged from hiding. And he goes out to meet him. And when he sees him, he hardly even recognizes him because he's been 13 years living in a cave. And his flesh is all pitted and pocked and withered. And he weeps and he says, woe to me that I would see you in such a state. But Shimon ben Yochai says, Ashrei are you, happy are you, that you would see me in this state. For if it was not for the state you see me in, I would not be so full of Torah. And so he tests that theory, because prior to the time in the cave, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai used to raise a question about Torah, and Ben Yair would answer with 13 answers. After 13 years in the cave, Ben Yair would ask a question of Torah, and Ben Yochai would answer with 24 answers. So now, who's the master, Darth? Pinchas ben Yair brought Shimon ben Yochai to the hot tubs at Tiberias to heal from his skin afflictions that he had apparently contracted while living in the sand in the cave. And he brings him to Tiberias where there's hot baths and he can convalesce there. See, on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, the city of Tiberias had been built about a century and a half earlier by Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas, the murderer of John the Immerser. Tiberias, it's the city where Salome danced at Herod's birthday party. You know that story. Anyway, originally, the capital city of the Galilee was a little town called Magdala. Magdala, Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene from Magdala. That's why she's called Magdalene. It's actually Miriam from Magdala. Anyway, so Herod wanted to move the capital. He wanted to build a proper Roman city, so he chose a new location just up the shore from Magdala, down the shore actually from Magdala, on the Sea of Galilee. And he wanted hot baths. So he went to Emmaus there on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, where there are some hot springs. You know, people always want to have hot baths. It was an amenity. Now, this isn't the same Emmaus that is mentioned in the Gospels. That Emmaus is more than 60, just 60 stadia away from Jerusalem, we learn. So several days here in down at Tiberias, it's a lot further than 3.5 miles or 7 miles. But like I said, any place you had hot baths, it was called Emmaus, or Chamat in Hebrew, right? Hot. There's a lot of Chamats in the land as well. Anyway, problem was, there really wasn't room here to build a city on the scale he wanted to build at Emmaus, because there was a cemetery there. Well, Herod doesn't mind. He's like, cemetery? These people have been dead a long time. So he just built right over the top of the cemetery, his city of Tiberias. so that in the days of the master, devout Jews avoided Tiberius like the plague because the cemetery made the whole city unclean. So Yeshua and his disciples, note this well, they never set foot in that city, ever, even though they were continually passing through the neighborhood. After the destruction of the temple, this was no longer an issue for most people, because, you know, if you became unclean, it's like, well, oh well, you know. Well, it's not going to make much difference anyway. So this became sort of a non-issue unless you were a Kohen, unless you're a priest. So Shimon ben Yochai can go to the hot baths. He goes to the hot baths at Tiberias, and that did the trick, and his skin healed after some time. And he wanted to express his gratitude to the city. So he asked, is there anything that I can do for the Jews here? And they told him about the problem with the cemetery and uncertainty about where the graves were, and it made it impossible for priests to get around the city. So he asked, well, is there anybody who knows the general vicinity of where those graves were? And there's one old man who could show him the location. And so Shimon ben Yochai proposes a plan. He plants lupines, which are a kind of flower lupines, that had been offered as truma to a priest. And he figures, since they're holy, these won't take root in unclean soil. So he plants these in the area, and wherever they took root, he declared it clean. Wherever they didn't take root, he said, there's a grave there. And they exhumed the graves. Some say that the bones actually rose out of the ground, that the bones grew up out of the ground. And then with the bodies removed, he was able to declare it clean. Declare the ground clean and declare the city clean. To annoy and discredit Shimon, a certain Samaritan, you know, these Samaritans, actually went by night and secretly replaced one of the bodies and reburied it. But you can't pull stuff like that on Shimon ben Yochai. So the Holy Spirit showed him what had happened. And so Shimon said, all right, he prayed, let what is above go down and what is below come up. So the bones rose, and the Samaritan died. This is what I mean. It was a little vindictive like that. There was also a sage, a head of an academy from nearby Magdala, who wasn't too happy with this purification of the city. And he says to Shimon, he says, oh, so the son of Yochai has purified a cemetery. He says, surprise, surprise, even prostitutes paint one another. So it's, you know, it's to your mutual advantage that you declare this city clean. So what did Shimon ben Yochai do? He fixed his gaze upon the man and reduced him to a heap of bones. It's the look. The sages can do this. I've been working on it. On another occasion, he saw his old disciple, Yehuda ben Garim, the man who had originally informed on him to the Romans, his personal Judas Iscariot. He said, is that man still in the world? And he fixed his eyes on him, reduced him to a pile of bones. Yeah, so he went to Maron. He set up an academy at a Galilean village called Tekoa. He became a famous teacher. Later in life, the Romans passed a new law forbidding the Jewish people from observing the Sabbath, one, circumcising their sons, two, and from observing the laws of family purity, three. I don't know how you enforce that, but anyway, that's what they did. And then the Jewish community said, well, this can't stand, this is a problem, we need to send ambassadors to Rome. So they elected Shimon ben Yochai to travel to Rome as an ambassador for the nation to argue for the repeal of the new law. Why did they select him? They said, well, he's accustomed to miracles. And they sent Eliezer ben Yossi with him. And when they arrived in Rome, the whole capital is astir because the emperor's daughter has, this is the creepy part, she's experiencing demonic convulsions. Now, actually, Rabbi Shimon knew what was up before he even got there because he previously encountered this evil spirit while still on the way to Rome, and he knew its name. So he presents himself to the court as an exorcist who's traveled from afar. They're like, give it a shot. He exorcises the demon. He already has this in. He knows the demon's name. exorcises the demon effortlessly. So the grateful emperor says, anything from my treasury, he opens his treasury, says, you can take one thing, anything. Anything is your reward. Rabbi Shimon looks through the documents until he finds the edict that has been written against the Jewish people. He says, I'll take this. He takes the document that was written against the Jewish people as his reward, and he tears it to pieces. That's the story. Anyway, back in Maron, he becomes a teacher. He has a lot of disciples. He teaches in the tradition of Rabbi Akiva. His rulings are based on. He was interested in more than just a rote observance. He approached halakhic questions with this idea that the commandment has an original intention. This isn't one of his rulings, but I'm just trying to give you an example of his logic process. You know, the ox, muzzle the ox. You can't muzzle an ox while it's treading out the grain. Would it be permissible to muzzle the ox if there was, this classic halakhic question, if there was a noxious plant growing that you knew the ox would eat and it would be poisonous to the ox? And some opinions say no. You still can't muzzle the ox. It says don't muzzle the ox. Shimon would say, what was the intention of the commandment? You know, the intention of the commandment is not to harm the ox. Right? So he thought through the Torah like that, and he brought a fresh perspective. He also based his rulings on his own mystical ideas, you know, this deep mysticism that he had absorbed in the cave. Moreover, he was a teacher of repentance. One of his famous quotes, he says, great is repentance. For even if a man has been completely wicked his entire life, if he repents before the end, he is considered a righteous man. Despite the stories of his own self-congratulations, he taught against pride and haughtiness. He compared haughtiness to idolatry, and he said, one should rather throw himself into a burning furnace than to shame his neighbor in public. And he had many other strong ethical statements like that, which on the surface might seem incongruous with the legends about him. But of course, he's most famous for the Zohar, which in reality was not even written by him, as I said. And I realized that many people in the Messianic, in Messianic Judaism are afraid of this book, you know. But like I said, most of the original founding fathers of this religion used it without hesitation. Paul Levertov was one of the greatest Zohar scholars of his generation. That's why this particular volume is his own translation of it. Listen to how his homeschooled daughter Olga described it. This is a homeschool girl for you. She says, the Zohar, or brightness, is the most important mystical work produced by Jewry in the Middle Ages. The Zohar influenced profoundly the mystical thought of future generations, and it was also known to Christian scholars of the period, and was a mine of theosophical and Gnostic-styled lore, as well as weird and pseudo-scientific ideas about astronomy, astrology, physiognomy, and other ingenuities. Purporting to be a work of Shimon ben Yochai, a second-century rabbi, it was supposed to have been discovered by Moses de Leon in the 13th century, who later asserted he had written it himself. That's not true. He'd never asserted that. But in reality, it is quite obviously the work of many authors. Much of the material goes back, in all probability, to a very early date, perhaps indeed to the second or even the first century, but its sources and its authors lie buried in the past, and its whole history is wrapped in obscurity. It is a literary curiosity, a historical enigma. Its style is cryptic to the point of being perfectly incomprehensible at times. It purports to be a commentary on the Torah, and so it is, but it is not in the least a commentary on the Torah as we read it. Every word and syllable, every phrase, every incident has an inner, supernal meaning, and these meanings build up into a sort of code of imagination, an airy structure on a different plane of reality, and everything is twisted out of its mundane context in order that it may yield a supernal implication. The book is therefore not the slightest use as a commentary on the Torah, but as a guide to the intricacies of Jewish mystical thought as a signpost to a strange dream country which has its own solidity and its own verities, which in time one comes to recognize with a sort of familiarity. As such a pointer, the Zohar is extraordinarily illuminating. Written mostly in Aramaic, in a kind of cryptic, abbreviated, illusory style which resembles nothing so much as some sort of supernal shorthand. That's a great summary of the Zohar. I know it was a little long, but I wanted to read it to you because I thought that's the best way to explain what's in this book. Shimon ben Yochai also taught that every commandment has some deeper spiritual meaning. Behind every seemingly mundane commandment of the Torah, there are layers and layers of spiritual meaning. Paul Levertov himself said, if Christians could but attain to a vision of the essence and core of their own faith, of 1,000th the intensity wherewith those Zoharatic rabbis plumbed the depths and scaled the heights of infinitude, then they might become more worthy of their title and even show to others a worthier, more thrilling, less man-exalting path to more distant, but oh, more glittering and lightful stars. How petty, how earthbound, how much like a clod the Zohar makes one feel. Undoubtedly, the vision and the ardor which crams its pages hardly needs refocusing with Christ as its center to make it a veritable Bible, not only of Jewish, but of Christian, and above all, Messianic Jewish mystics. And what mystics ought not they to be? The legend says that on the day of his death, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai knew that it had been decreed for him to die that day. So he said to his disciples, I desire to reveal secrets to you. And he began to download his teachings, his mystical insights into their minds as fast as he could, teaching as fast as he could, because he knew time was short. And this was the basis of the body of teaching that became the Zohar eventually. But the problem was there was not enough time in the day for him to teach all of this. So a miracle happened. The daylight was miraculously extended until Rabbi Shimon had completed his final teaching. And then he died. That's the legend. This miracle is symbolized by the divine light. It symbolizes the divine light of revelation, you know, contained in those mystical teachings. And as such, the custom of lighting bonfires on Lag BaOmer symbolizes this extension of the day and the revelation of a powerful light. That's the story. So what do you think? The story of this road to Emmaus, a different Emmaus, and the road to Meron. Maybe like me, you have mixed feelings about Shimon ben Yochai and his Zohar. That's okay. He's not your master. He's not even one of our boys in that sense. And the Zohar is certainly not the Gospels or the Apostles. It's not the Bible. But the story, just the story, reminds me of the revelation on the road to Emmaus, the other Emmaus, the Emmaus in the Gospel, where our Master took the Torah that his disciples thought they knew, had always known, turned it upside down on them, and revealed to them the hidden meanings and the revelations within it that they had never seen before. Where it says, then beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself. And then they said to each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he was speaking to us on the road? And he was explaining to us the scriptures. And that's what the Lag BaOmer bonfire, I think, means to me. It should mean to us. Our hearts burning within us, set ablaze with the divine revelation of the concealed light, revealed to us through the new Torah, through our teacher, not Shimon ben Yochai, but Yeshua of Nazareth, an earlier Galilean sage, who was also accused of being an insurrectionist and a revolutionary, who was also sentenced to death by Rome and crucified, who also had the merit to carry the generations from Abraham on, who performed miracles and healings, signs and wonders, cast out demons, revealed the true light to his disciples. As it says, he opened up their minds so they could understand the scriptures. That's what Lag BaOmer should mean to us, the light of revelation. And whether that revelation comes from the way to Emmaus or from Meron, true revelation All true revelation comes from the same source. As James, the brother of the Master, said, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good thing given, every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow."
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.